everybody to this invited session on science and religion. Are they compatible? Today we have two very distinguished speakers who will be trying to answer that question. Professor Alvin Plantinga from the University of Notre Dame will be the main speaker, and the commentator will be Professor Dan Dennett from Tufts University. I think the format we'll use is we'll give the speakers about an hour to go at it, and then we'll open up the questions. I think it's about a half hour for questions and answers. The main speaker today, Professor Plantinga, the title of his talk is Science and Religion, Where the Conflict Really Lies. Join me in welcoming.
Thanks very much, Bill. Is this microphone working? Okay. Science and Religion, Where the Conflict Really Lies. That's the title. Our question is this: are science and religion compatible? A useful project would be to try to make this question more precise. What is religion? What is science? What is incompatibility? And in what varieties does it come? There is explicit contradiction, implicit contradiction, contradiction in the presence of plausible assumptions, improbability of conjunction, and the like. Some claim that theism itself is inconsistent, in which case, naturally enough, it will be incompatible with science and everything else. Others retort that the same goes for science. Current general relativity is incompatible with current quantum theory, so that current science itself is inconsistent, in which case it is incompatible with religion and everything else. These are good topics, but they'll have to wait for another occasion. Here I'll assume that we have at least a pretty good rough grasp of the question. I won't be talking about religion generally, but about specifically theistic religion, and in particular Christian belief, but the Christian part will be less important than the theistic part. When I speak of Christian belief, I'm thinking of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, something like the intersection of the great Christian creeds. So although what I say is explicitly concerned with Christian belief, it will also be relevant to many varieties of Judaism and Islam. Why I think there is conflict here? Many suggestions have been offered. Theistic religion, for example, theistic religion endorses special divine action in the world, miracles, for example, but such action would contradict the laws promulgated by science. Another example, there is such a thing as the scientific worldview, and it is incompatible with theistic religion. Christian belief implies that human beings have been created in God's image, but contemporary evolutionary theory, properly understood, implies that neither God nor anyone else has designed, planned, or intended that human beings come to be. Evolutionary psychology is full of theories that are incompatible with theistic understandings of human beings. Some scientific biblical scholarship argues that historical claims of Christianity, for example, that Jesus rose from the dead, are false, or anyway groundless. These are all of great interest, but I'll limit myself on this talk to a cluster of issues having to do with evolution. I'll argue, one, that contemporary evolutionary theory is not incompatible with theistic belief. Two, that the main anti-theistic arguments involving evolution together with other premises also fail. Three, that even if current science, evolutionary or otherwise, were incompatible with theistic belief, it wouldn't follow that theistic belief is irrational or unwarranted or in any other kind of trouble. And finally, four, that naturalism, the thought that there is no such person as God, as the God of the theistic religions, or anything like God, is an essential element in the naturalistic worldview, which is a sort of quasi-religion itself, in the sense that it plays some of the most important roles of religion, and I'll argue that the naturalistic worldview is in fact incompatible with evolution. And so there is a science, or quasi-science, religion conflict, all right, but, I'm sorry, there is a science and religion, or quasi-religion, conflict, all right, but it's a conflict between naturalism and science, not between theistic religion and science. So, part one, contemporary evolutionary theory is compatible with theistic belief. The term evolution covers a variety of theses. There is the ancient earth thesis, for example. There is the thesis of descent with modification. That is the thought that the enormous diversity of the contemporary living world has come about by way of offspring differing, ordinarily, in small and subtle ways from their parents. There is the common ancestry thesis, the claim that, as Gould put it, there is a tree of evolutionary descent linking all organisms by ties of genealogy. I'll use the term evolution to refer to the conjunction of these three theses. There's also, four, the claim that the principal mechanism driving this process of descent with modification is natural selection. Natural selection winnowing random genetic mutation. Since a similar proposal was characteristic of Darwin, he said natural selection has been the main but not exclusive means of modification. Call this thesis Darwinism. So that's the fourth thesis. Now it's clear, I think, that there's no conflict between theistic religion and the ancient earth thesis, or the descent with modification thesis, or the common ancestry thesis. According to theistic belief, God has created the living world, but of course he could have done so in many different ways, and in particular, in ways compatible with these theses. What about the fourth thesis, Darwinism? Is it incompatible with theistic religion? Many apparently think so. Among them are Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, seated here to my left, George Gaylord Simpson, and many others, and far to the other side, Philip Johnson. But are they right? Where exactly would such an incompatibility arise? A suggested source of conflict has to do with the Christian doctrine of creation, in particular the claim that God has created human beings in his image. This requires that God intended to create creatures of a certain kind and planned that there be creatures of that kind, rational creatures perhaps, with a moral sense and the capacity to know and love him. It requires that God intended to create creatures of such a kind and then acted in such a way as to accomplish this intention. This claim is clearly consistent with evolution, those first three theses, as conservative Christian theologians have pointed out as far back as 1871 with Charles Hodge at Princeton. But is it also consistent with Darwinism? It looks as if it is. God could have caused the right mutations to arise at the right time. He could have preserved populations from perils of various sorts, and so on. And in this way, by orchestrating the course of evolution, he could have ensured that there come to be creatures of the kind he intends. Now, what is not consistent with Christian belief, however, is the claim that evolution and Darwinism are unguided, where I'll take that to include being unplanned and unintended. What is not consistent with Christian belief is the claim that no personal agent, not even God, has guided, planned, intended, directed, orchestrated, or shaped this whole process. Yet precisely this claim is made by a large number of contemporary scientists and philosophers who write on this topic. There is a veritable choir of distinguished experts insisting that this process is unguided, indeed sometimes insisting that it is part of evolutionary theory itself, the contemporary evolutionary scientific theory of evolution itself, to assert that it is unguided, so that evolutionary theory as such is incompatible with Christian belief. According to George Gaylord Simpson, for example, man, and no doubt woman as well, is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind. In this connection, the late Stephen Jay Gould and others have emphasized what they take to be the chancy, contingent, and undirected character of evolution. If the evolutionary tape were to be rewound and then let go forward again, the chances are we'd get creatures of a very different sort from the ones actually present on Earth. The chances are we'd get nothing much like Homo sapiens. But Gould's suggestion, I think, presupposes that God has not guided and orchestrated the course of evolution, and hence can't be appealed to as a reason for supposing that he has not done so. Given the biological evidence and the proposition that God has indeed created human beings in his image, given those two things, Gould's suggestion is wholly implausible. For if the tape were rewound and let go forward again, no doubt God still would have intended that there be creatures created in his image, and would still have seen to it that there be such creatures. What about the fact that genetic mutation are said to be random. You might wonder whether genetic mutations could be both random and intended and caused by God. If these mutations are random, aren't they just a matter of chance, blind chance? But it is no part of current evolutionary theory to say that these mutations are random, in a sense implying that they are uncaused. They are said to be caused by cosmic rays, for example, and still less that they occur just by chance. According to Ernst Mayr, the dean of post-World War II biology, he says, when it is said that mutation or variation is random, the statement simply means that there is no correlation between the production of new genotypes and the adaptational needs of an organism in a given environment. Elliot Kober puts the point a bit more carefully, or maybe more fully. He says, there is no physical mechanism, either inside organisms or outside of them, that detects which mutations would be beneficial and causes those mutations to occur. The point is that a mutation accruing to an organism is random, just as neither the organism nor its environment contains a mechanism or process or organ that causes adaptive mutations to occur. But clearly a mutation could be both random in that sense and also intended and indeed caused by God. Hence, the randomness involved in Darwinism does not imply that the process is not divinely guided. The fact, if it is a fact, that human beings have come to be by way of natural selection, operating on random genetic mutation, is not at all incompatible with their having been designed by God and created in His image. Therefore, Darwinism is entirely compatible with God's guiding, orchestrating, and overseeing the whole process. Indeed, it's perfectly compatible with the idea that God causes the random genetic mutations that are winnowed by natural selection. Maybe all of them, maybe just some. Those who claim that evolution shows that humankind and other living things have not been designed apparently confuse the naturalistic gloss on the scientific theory with the theory itself. The claim that evolution demonstrates that human beings and other living creatures have not, contrary to appearances, been designed, is not a part of or a consequence of the scientific theory as such, but a metaphysical or theological add-on. Naturalism implies, of course, that we human beings have not been designed and created in God's image, because it implies that there is no such person as God. But evolutionary science by itself does not carry this implication. Naturalism and evolutionary theory together imply the denial of divine design, but evolutionary theory by itself doesn't have that implication. It is only evolutionary science combined with naturalism that implies this denial. Since naturalism all by itself has this implication, it's no surprise that when you can join it with science, or as far as that goes, anything else, the complete works of William E. McGonigal, poet and tragedian, for example, or the Farmer's Almanac, or the Apostles' Creed, the conjunction will also have this implication. Section 2, broader anti-theistic arguments from evolution. So Darwinism as such doesn't include or imply the proposition that the process is unguided. What about broader anti-theistic arguments involving evolution? I'm aware of three sorts of arguments proposed here. First, there is the claim that evolution undercuts the argument from design, thus reducing the rational support, if any, enjoyed by theism. Second, there is the claim that the process of evolution, so wasteful and productive of suffering, is not the sort of process God would use or permit. And thirdly, there is the thought that unguided evolution, as a hypothesis, is superior to the hypothesis that the process of evolution has been guided or orchestrated by mind, divine or otherwise, because it is simpler and more optimistic. None of these objections, I believe, is promising. While I can't deal properly, really, with any of them, let alone all of them, in the time I have, I'll briefly outline a response to each. Start with a claim that evolution undercuts the argument from design, thus making it less reasonable to accept theistic belief. According to John Dupré, quote, Darwinism undermines the only remotely plausible reason for believing in the existence of God, that is, the argument from design. Now, it's reasonable to think that evolution makes it somewhat easier to be rational, to be rational or sensible in accepting atheism. Prior to 1859, there simply weren't decent answers to the question, if this abundant variety of life wasn't created by God, how did it get here? And in this connection, Richard Dawkins says, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. But making it easier to be a rational atheist doesn't as such make it harder to be a rational theist, and doesn't as such create a religion-science conflict. And how much support does the argument from design actually offer theistic belief anyway? Perhaps it suggests belief in the existence of a very powerful, very knowledgeable being or group of beings, but that's a long ways from theism. In any event, however, current molecular biology may offer the materials for a different sort of argument from design, as explained in the much maligned Michael Behe's recent book, The Edge of Evolution. Michael Behe is indeed much maligned. His argument is one of the few serious and quantitative arguments in this area. We have the living cell, both prokaryotic and eukaryotic, with its stupefying complexity and its multitude of elaborately complex protein machines. Behe argues that unguided natural selection is probably incapable of producing these protein machines. His argument is quantitative and empirical, rather than a priori. Its centerpiece is the saga of the malaria parasite, Plasmodium falciparum, and its long trench warfare with the human genome. I don't have the space here to outline this argument, but to me as a layman, the argument seems reasonably powerful, though very far from conclusive. If Behe is right, or anywhere nearly right, the probability of the existence of the cell as we find it is much greater on theism than on naturalism. And if this is so, the argument from design is reinstated at a different level, at a deeper level. What current biological science takes away with one hand, it restores with the other. But the real point lies in a different direction. Belief in God is seldom accepted on the basis of the teleological argument, or indeed any argument or propositional evidence at all. Both untutored observation and current research in the scientific study of religion suggest that a tendency to believe in God or something very much like God, apart from any propositional evidence, is part of our native cognitive endowment. Furthermore, if theistic belief is true, it probably doesn't require propositional evidence for its rational acceptability. As I argued in this book, Warranted Christian Belief, if theistic belief is true, then very likely it has both rationality and warrant in the basic way, that is, not on the basis of propositional evidence. If theistic belief is true, then very likely there is a cognitive structure, something like John Calvin's sensus divinitatis, an original source of warranted theistic belief. In this way, belief in God, like belief in other minds, has its own source of rationality and warrant, and doesn't depend on arguments from other sources for these estimable qualities. The demise of the teleological argument, if indeed evolution has compromised it, is perhaps a little more of a threat to rational belief in God than the demise of the argument from analogy for other minds is to rational belief in other minds. Second, there's a suggestion made by Gould and others that the waste and suffering involved in evolution is evidence against theism. Philip Kitcher puts it like this. He says, when we envisage a human analog presiding over a miniaturized version of the arrangement, it's hard to equip the face with a kindly expression. And then he goes on to suggest, had a benevolent creator proposed to use evolution under natural selection as a means for attaining his purposes, we could have given him some useful advice. I'm not sure how such advice would be received, but of course we don't require current evolutionary theory or current science at all to tell us that the animal world is full of predation, death, pain, and suffering. Alfred Lord Tennyson noted that, quote, nature is red in tooth and claw, well before 1859, and no doubt some suspected it even earlier. Still, current science gives us reason to believe that suffering and death have afflicted the human and animal world for a much longer time than was ordinarily thought before the 19th century. It has therefore given us information about the extent and duration of animal suffering, including human suffering. The first thing to see here, I think, is that this is a special case of the so-called problem of evil, a problem that is alleged to afflict theistic belief. Sin and suffering do indeed constitute a problem or complexity for theism, although it may be hard to specify precisely what the problem is. Most atheist thinkers have given up the idea that the existence of sin and suffering is logically incompatible with theistic belief, some kind of inductive or probabilistic anti-theistic argument is presumably what's at issue. It has proven surprisingly difficult, however, to give a really plausible statement of a probabilistic argument from evil, and as these arguments become more complex, they also seem to become less convincing. Surely, however, sin and suffering and evil present some kind of problem, or at least perplexity, for theists. The existence of so much suffering and hurt in God's world certainly seems to call out for an explanation of some sort. And what current biological science adds to the problem is that predation, suffering, and death have been going on for a very long time. But does this put any additional pressure on the various theistic or Christian responses to suffering and evil? My own favorite response is the, quote, O Felix Culpa, unquote, response, according to which all of the really good possible worlds involve divine incarnation and atonement, or at any rate, atonement. But then all of the best possible worlds also involve a great deal of sin, and as a consequence, a great deal of suffering. Some of this suffering is on the part of non-human creatures. Christians think of suffering, both human and non-human, as due in one way or another to sin, although not necessarily to human sin. There are also Satan and his minions, who may, as C.S. Lewis suggests, be involved in one way or another in the evolution of the non-human living world. But learning that sin and suffering have been going on for longer than we had originally thought shouldn't raise any additional difficulty for the old Felix Culpa response. Suppose we learn that our world, with all its problems, heartaches, and cruelty, will endure for millions of years before the advent of the new heaven and the new earth. That wouldn't have much bearing, one thinks, on the viability or satisfactoriness of this response to evil. The new heaven and the new earth, after all, will exist for a vastly longer period than our current sad and troubled old world. Officially, at least, it will be such a long period that the length of time our current sad and troubled old world exists isn't any proportion of it at all. But the same goes, I should think, for our learning that our world, with all the ills it's heir to, has gone on for much longer than originally thought. Current science shows that suffering, both human and animal, has gone on much longer than previously thought, but it doesn't thereby diminish the value of Christian responses to the problem of evil, and in this way doesn't exacerbate that problem much, if at all. Finally, there is the claim, perhaps made more often in the oral tradition than in print, that the hypothesis of unguided evolution is simpler, more in accord with optimistic injunctions, than the hypothesis that God or other intelligent beings have shaped and guided the course of terrestrial evolution. Here, two points are relevant. First, even if unguided evolution is more optimistic than guided evolution, it isn't at all clear that the former is, all things considered, superior as a hypothesis to the latter. It involves fewer kinds of beings, yes, but that isn't the only relevant consideration. Another is their respective likelihoods, that is, the probabilities of the living world, more exactly, the variety of the living world, coming to be by way of these two hypotheses. Let D be the proposition that the variety of the living world has come to be by Darwinian processes, E the relevant biological evidence, G the proposition that evolution is unguided, and U the proposition that it is unguided. Then our question is which is greater, the probability of D on E and G, or the probability of D on E and U? It is, of course, overwhelmingly difficult to make anything like reasonably precise judgments here, but perhaps we can make sensible comparative judgments. Consider first P of D on E and G. Clearly, God could have created living things by way of natural selection, causing the right mutations to arise at the right time, preserving the relevant populations from disaster, and so on. He could also have allowed other intelligent creatures to be involved in the whole process. Again, it is overwhelmingly difficult to estimate the probability that this is the way in which it, has in fact happened, but P of D on E and G is perhaps not terribly low. What about P of D on E and U? Going all the way back to St. George Vibert, critics have expressed serious doubts as to whether the I, for example, could have come to be by way of unguided natural selection operating on random genetic mutation. Could, that is, apart from absolutely stunning improbability. The eye, the mammalian brain, and other organs remain difficult problems for unguided evolution. But the really hard problem here for unguided Darwinism isn't the development of macroscopic organs such as eyes and hearts. The hard problem is rather at the microscopic, molecular level, the stupefying complexity of the living cell, both prokaryotic and eukaryotic. So, for example, Bruce Alberts, who's president of the National Academy of Science, when he wrote this, says, nearly every process in a cell is carried out by assemblies of 10 or more protein molecules. Indeed, the entire cell can be viewed as a factory that contains an elaborate network of interacting assembly lines, each of which is composed of a set of large protein machines. It's only in the last half century or so that this enormous complexity has come to view. The eminent scientist Ernst Haeckel summed up 19th century opinion when he declared the cell, quote, a simple little lump of albuminous combination of carbon. Of course, it's widely assumed that in fact the cell must have come to be in that fashion, but there's little by way of serious argument for the conclusion that it's coming to be in this way is less than prohibitively improbable. On the other hand, as I said above, Michael Behe has proposed a serious and quantitative argument for the opposite conclusion. Given the stunning complexity of the living cell with its enormous complication, together with what we know about mutation rates, the age of the Earth, population sizes, and the like, it seems reasonable, or maybe not unreasonable, to estimate that P of D on E and U is exceedingly low, perhaps orders of magnitude lower than P of D on E and G. If this is right, then even if we think U, as an explanation, is optimistically superior to G, it is inferior to G in that the relevant likelihood is lower. But again, the real point lies in a different direction. The theistic noetic structure already, of course, includes the existence of God. Relative to that noetic structure, therefore, there is no additional optimistic cause in the hypothesis of guided evolution. As an analogy, suppose we land a spaceship on a planet we know is inhabited by intelligent creatures. We find something that looks exactly like a stone arrowhead, complete with grooves and indentations, apparently made in the process of shaping and sharpening it. Two possibilities suggest themselves. One, that it acquired these characteristics by way of erosion, let's say, and the other, that it was intentionally designed and fashioned by the inhabitants. Someone with a couple of courses in philosophy might suggest that the former hypothesis is to be preferred because it posits fewer entities than the latter. He'd be wrong, of course, since we already know the planet contains intelligent creatures. There is no optimistic cost involved in thinking these structures designed. The same would go for evolution. Theists already accept divine design and do not incur additional optimistic cost by way of thinking of evolution as guided. This objection to guided evolution would have more by way of if we, theists and atheists alike, were starting from an agnostic position, and then the theist proposed to postulate the existence of a divine designer in order to explain the course of evolution. That would be substantially like offering a theistic argument. And then the availability of a non-theistic alternative hypothesis, provided the relevant likelihood wasn't too overwhelmingly small, would indeed undercut the argument. But of course, in this context, the theist isn't presenting a theistic argument. She already accepts divine design, and hence the fact that guided evolution involves more entities than unguided evolution is no reason in favor, with respect to her noetic structure, no reason in favor of the latter. Since that is so, there is no conflict here between theistic religion and evolutionary science. I've argued that contemporary scientific theories, theory of evolution, taken as including Darwinism, does not entail the claim that natural selection is unguided. But suppose I'm mistaken, or suppose instead that current evolutionary theory itself evolves in such a way that this claim becomes part of it. This could certainly happen. We can easily imagine the authorities in the textbooks stating the theory in such a way as to explicitly include the claim that natural selection is unguided by any personal agent. After all, many, perhaps most biologists, believe that it is unguided. Would that show that there is scientific evidence against theism? Hardly. We can imagine physics evolving in the same direction. All the physics textbooks unite in endorsing general relativity, adding that the behavior of large-scale physical systems is never guided by any personal agents. In either case, obviously, would it follow that there is scientific evidence against theism? Annexing a proposition P to one for which there is evidence doesn't automatically confer evidence on P. I learned that Whitey is a Frisian lifeguard. That increases the probability that he can swim. It also increases the probability of the proposition Whitey can swim and the next toss of this coin will land heads. But it does not increase the probability that the next toss of this coin will land heads. And even if, contrary to fact, there were scientific evidence for unguided evolution and hence for atheism, that would by no means settle the issue. Suppose there is scientific evidence against theism. It doesn't follow that theism is false, or that theists have a defeater for their beliefs, or that theistic belief is irrational, or is in some other way problematic. Perhaps there is also scientific evidence or otherwise for theism. But second, and more important, as I mentioned, if theism is true, it is likely that it has its own intrinsic and basic source of warrant, something like the sensus divinitatis proposed by John Calvin, or the natural but confused knowledge of God proposed by Thomas Aquinas. If so, the warrant for theistic belief doesn't depend on the state of current science. Indeed, what Christians and other theists should think of current science can quite properly depend, in part, on theology. For example, science has not spoken with a single voice about the question whether the universe has a beginning. First, the idea was that it did, but then the steady state theory triumphed, but then Big Bang cosmology achieved ascendancy, but now there are straws in the wind suggesting a reversion to the thought that the universe is without beginning. The sensible Christian believer is not obliged to trim her sails to the current scientific breeze on this topic, revising her belief on the topic every time science changes its mind. If the most satisfactory Christian or theistic theology endorses the idea that the universe did indeed have a beginning, isn't eternal, let's say, the believer has the perfect right to accept that thought. If so, then even if there were scientific evidence against theism, and no propositional evidence, arguments, let's say, scientific or otherwise in favor of it, it still might be both rational and warranted. Finally, section 3, naturalism versus evolution. Naturalism comes in more than one variety. Here, as I said, I take it to be the view that there is no such person as the God of theistic religion, nor anything at all like God. So taken, naturalism is not a religion. Nevertheless, it is a crucial part of the naturalistic worldview, which in turn plays at least one of the most important roles of a religion. This worldview functions as a sort of myth, in a technical sense of that term. It offers a way of interpreting ourselves to ourselves, a way of understanding our origin and significance at the deep level of religion. It tells us where we come from, what our prospects are, what our place in the universe is, whether there is life after death, and the like. We could therefore say that it is a quasi-religion. What I propose to argue next is that naturalism and current science are incompatible, so that there is a religion, or quasi-religion, science conflict, sure enough, but it's between science and naturalism, not science and theistic religion. What I'll argue is that naturalism is incompatible with evolution in the sense that one can't rationally accept them both. Since I've given this argument elsewhere, I can be brief. First, note that naturalists are all or nearly all materialists about human persons. A human person is a material object through and through, with no immaterial self or soul or subject. For present purposes, therefore, I'll assimilate materialism to naturalism. The central premises of the argument are as follows, where N is naturalism, E is current evolutionary theory, and R is the proposition that our cognitive faculties are reliable. The argument goes like this. First premise, the probability of R on N and E is low. Second premise, one who accepts N and E and sees that one is true as a defeater for R. Third premise, this defeater can't be itself defeated. Fourth premise, one who has a defeater for R has a defeater for any belief she takes to be produced by her cognitive faculties, including N and E itself. Therefore, conclusion five, N and E is self-defeating, and hence can't rationally be accepted. These premises need defense, perhaps the first one in particular. So, suppose there are beliefs. This isn't essential to the argument, for one, but it will facilitate brief statement of it. From the point of view of materialism, a belief will presumably be an event or structure in the nervous system, perhaps in the brain. It will be a structure involving many neurons connected in various ways. This structure will respond to input from other such structures, from sense organs, and so on. It may also send signals along effector nerves to muscles and glands, thereby causing behavior. Such a structure will have at least two kinds of properties. On the one hand, it will have neurophysiological properties, called NP properties, specifying, for example, the number of neurons involved in the structure, the rate of fire in various parts of it, the change in rate of fire in one part in response to change of rate of fire in another, the way in which it is connected with other structures and with muscles and the like. But if it is a belief, it will also have a property of quite a different sort, a mental property. It will have a content. It will be the belief that P for some proposition P. NP properties are physical properties. Having such and such a content is a mental property. There are three ways in which, given materialism, mental and physical properties can be related. First, non-reductive materialism. While mental properties can't be reduced to physical properties, they supervene on them. And take supervenience to be like this, properties of sort A supervene on properties of sort B, just if necessarily, if entities X and Y differ with respect to their A properties, then they differ with respect to their B properties. The necessity involved can be either broadly logical, metaphysical necessity, or nomological necessity, giving us two varieties of supervenience, logical and nomological, and hence two possibilities as to the relation of mental properties to physical properties. The third possibility for that relation is reductive materialism, according to which every mental property is identical with some physical property. Now, in order to avoid interspecific chauvinism, suppose we think not about ourselves, but about a population of creatures, perhaps in one of those other cosmoi proposed by inflationary scenarios, who resemble us in holding beliefs, changing beliefs, making inferences, and so on. Suppose also that naturalism holds for these creatures, and that they have come to be by the processes specified in contemporary evolutionary theory. Now ask about P of R on N and E, specified not to us, but to them, and consider that probability with respect to each of the three suggestions about the relation of mental and physical properties. Consider first logical non-reductive materialism, call it LNM. Mental properties are distinct from physical properties, but supervene upon them, where the necessity involved is broadly logical. What is P of R on N and E and logical non-reductive materialism? While these creatures have evolved, we may therefore assume that their behavior is adaptive in their circumstances, and that accordingly, the neurophysiology producing that behavior is also adaptive. But natural selection doesn't give a fig about true belief just as such. It rewards adaptive behavior and punishes maladaptive behavior, but it doesn't care about the truth of a belief. As Patricia Churchman says, quote, truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost. So choose any particular belief B held by one of these creatures. We may assume that B is adaptive and that its NP properties are adaptive. But of course, nothing so far follows about the truth or falsehood of the content that supervenes on these properties. If the supervening content is true, excellent. But if it is false, that's just as good. Its falsehood in no way interferes with the adaptivity of the NP properties. We should assume, therefore, that the probability of that belief being true, given NP and non-reductive logical supervenience, is about a half. But then the probability of their faculties being reliable will be low. If you have 100 independent beliefs and the probability of each is a half, the probability that 3/4 of them are true, which is a modest enough requirement for reliability, will be less than 1 out of 1,000,000. So P of R on NNE and LNM, therefore, is low. But the same thing holds, and for the same reasons, for P of R on NNE and NNM, where NNM is the version of non-reductive materialism where mental properties supervene upon physical properties with no logical necessity. That leaves reductive materialism, which we'll call RM. What is P of R on N and E and RM? Here the property of having such and such a content is identical with some physical property, presumably a neurological property. Again, consider any particular belief B held by one of these creatures. We may suppose that having this belief B is adaptive, and adaptive by virtue of its content as well as its other physical properties. But once again, it doesn't matter whether the content associated with B is true or false. We may assume that the physical property identical with the property of having B's content is adaptive. The content associated with B is, of course, either true or false. If it happens to be false, this in no way compromises the adaptivity of B. Once more, then, we must suppose that the probability of that belief being true is about a half. But then it will be unlikely that the cognitive faculties of these creatures are reliable. It follows, therefore, that P of R on NNE with respect to these hypothetical creatures is low. But then, of course, the same goes for us. P of R on NNE is low specified to us as well. The next step to note is to note that anyone who sees that P of R on NNE is low and also accepts NNE as a defeater for R in her own case, a reason for rejecting R, for giving it up, for no longer believing it. This defeater cannot itself be defeated. That is because the defeater for this defeater would have to take the form of an argument. But of course, one who accepts NNE will also have a defeater for the premises of this argument, as well as for the proposition that if the premises are true, so is the conclusion. Another way to put it, any argument for R will be epistemically circular, and that reliance on the argument presupposes that the conclusion of the argument is true. But anyone who has a defeater for R has a defeater for any belief he takes to be produced by her cognitive faculties, including, of course, NNE itself. Hence, one who accepts NNE and sees the truth of that first premise has a defeater for NNE. NNE, therefore, is self-defeating and cannot rationally be accepted. If so, however, there is a conflict between naturalism and evolution. Their conjunction cannot rationally be accepted. Evolution, however, is one of the pillars of contemporary science. Hence, there is a science-religion, or perhaps science-quasi-religion conflict in the neighborhood of evolution, all right, but not between evolution and theistic religion. The real conflict is between evolution, that pillar of contemporary science, and naturalism. Thank you.
Professor Flanagan, Professor Dan Dennett from Tufts University.
what I'm going to do, let's see, I guess I need to use the microphone. Let's see, can I move this any closer without unplugging it? I guess this will have to do. What I'm going to do... to show that three of Professor Clannan's central claims are right, but only in senses that fail to support his larger project. Then I will also rebut his argument that naturalism is inconsistent with belief in evolution. So here are the three true claims that he makes. One, contemporary evolutionary theory is compatible with theistic belief. Two, it is no part of current evolutionary theory to say that mutations are random in the sense implying that they just occur just by chance. Three, naturalism and evolutionary theory together imply the denial of divine design, but evolutionary biology by itself doesn't have that implication. So I think these are all true, but I think they don't do the job that Plantinga thinks they do. I'm going to go through one at a time. So here we go. With the first one, contemporary evolutionary theory is compatible with theistic belief. Now, Clannan is right about this, given the way he defines his terms, and lurking within his claims is an important point that I myself have often stressed since I first expressed it in 1990. Suppose we were to send Martian biologists a laying hen, a Pekingese dog, a barn swallow, and a cheetah, and ask them to determine which designs bore the mark of intervention by artificial selectors. What could they rely on? And my claim is that it would be very hard, if not impossible, for them to tell. Let's look at a few. Where do we see signs of design? Well, we see a barn swallow that lives in a nest in a human habitation. We see a ridiculous little dog on the left. We see a beautiful cheetah. It's not so clear how to tell. Or look at these two. We have a greyhound, the product of artificial selection, and the cheetah, product of natural selection. It's not easy to tell in these cases. What could they rely on? How would they argue, these Martian scientists? They might note that the hen did not care properly for her eggs. Some varieties of hen have had the instinct for broodiness bred right out of them. It would soon become extinct were it not for the environment of artificial incubators that human beings have provided for them. They might note that the Pekingese was pathetically ill-suited for fending for itself in any demanding environment. The barn swallow's fondness for carpentered nest sites might fool them into the view that it was some sort of pet. And whatever features of the cheetah convinced them that it was a creature of the wild might also be found in greyhounds and have been patiently encouraged by breeders. Artificial environments are themselves a part of nature, after all. Prehistoric fiddling with intergalactic visitors with the DNA of earthly species cannot be ruled out, except on grounds that it is an entirely gratuitous feature. Oh, before I pursue that, I want to just show you how hard it is to tell signs of intelligent design. Which of these is an artifact? How many say the one on the left? Maybe they're both artifacts. How many the one on the right? Okay. Well, the one on the right is not an artifact at all. It was created by geological processes just freezing and thawing in the Arctic. The one on the left is an Andy Goldsworthy sculpture. So look at them again. And if you wonder how on earth could those beautiful nests of colored stones be created, you can go to the... Oh, here's another good case. Which are the designed artifacts in this case? The upper left and the bottom right are both non-designed. They are simply, again, a result of freezing and thawing in different sorts of Arctic tundra, whereas the rice paddies on the lower left and another Andy Goldsworthy sculpture on the right. And if you're interested in what the processes look like, you can consult the relevant article in Science that shows how these formed just by natural and unintended and undirected sifting of various sorts. It's also true that natural selection is sometimes just very hard to imagine, even by professionals. Alvin quoted a wonderful passage from, I guess it was Haeckel, wasn't it, about the mere blob of the cell. But here's an even better one, I think, from William Bateson, one of the fathers of modern genetics. And here's what he had to say not so long ago in 1916. The properties of living things are in some way attached to a material basis, perhaps in some special degree to nuclear chromatin. And yet it is inconceivable that particles of chromatin or any other substance, however complex, can possess those powers which must be assigned to our factors or genes. That's his word for gene. The supposition that particles of chromatin, indistinguishable from each other, and indeed almost homogeneous under any known test, can by their material nature confer all the properties of life, surpasses the range of the most convinced materialism. He just could not imagine DNA. The idea that there might be 3 billion base pairs in a double helix inside every cell was simply not within the scope of his imagination. I like this example because it nicely illustrates one of my pet themes about philosophers, but it's not just philosophers, who mistake the failure of imagination for an insight into necessity. That is certainly a case in point here. Back to our thesis here. This is continuing the quote from my paper some years ago. Prehistoric fiddling by intergalactic visitors with the DNA of earthly species cannot be ruled out except on grounds that it is an entirely gratuitous fantasy. Nothing we have found so far on Earth so much as hints that such a hypothesis is worth further exploration. And note, I hasten to add, lest creationists take heart, even if we were to discover and translate such a trademark message in our spare DNA, this would do nothing to rescind the claim of the theory of natural selection to explain all design in nature without invocation of a foresighted designer creator outside the system. If the theory of evolution by natural selection can account for the existence of the people at Novogene, that's a company that many years ago put its Novogene brand on the DNA products that they made, so that they signed their work. It was a nice cyber trick. Well, if they can do it now, so our ancestors or our creators from some other galaxy could have done it a long time ago. So, in other words, even if we found user's manuals hidden in the so-called junk DNA of our genomes, this would not necessarily. It wouldn't show that natural selection was not the answer, because we could have been tampered with by intergalactic intelligences of an entirely non-supernatural sort many years ago. So I agree with Alvin that contemporary evolutionary theory can't demonstrate the absence of intelligent design. Any biologist who insists that it can is overstating the case. But Alvin must deal with the implications of another sentence from that paper. Except on grounds that it is an entirely gratuitous fantasy. Now, we might draw the debate to a close right here. I could happily concede that anybody who wishes to entertain the fantasy that an intelligent designer, or intelligent designers from another galaxy or another dimension, fiddled with our evolutionary prehistory, or salted Earth with life forms, or even arranged for the constants of physics to take on their particular local values, will find their fantasy consistent with contemporary evolutionary biology. So I could just simply concede that point to Alvin at this point. There's not a shred of evidence for any such fantasy, but it's a free country, and as Alvin says at one point, it is within the rights of a believing theist to go on believing that a personal and intelligent creator played a role. It's a free country, but it might be harmless, and it might be harmless enough to keep such fairy tales alive, but in general I think it is wise of us not to respect such frivolities, since they can, in fact, do serious damage to the epistemological fabric of our society. For instance, they might mislead deluded people into basing policy on them. For instance, by offering public sacrifices to those imagined intelligent designers in hopes of enticing them to return and repair our damaged planet. Or to take two entirely real and utterly deplorable examples, they might mislead deluded people into dismissing environmental concerns since the end times are nigh. But let me go back and should we tolerate astrology? We should tolerate it, but we shouldn't respect it. I think astrology, the ambient acceptance of astrology, actually has a malign effect on the epistemological fabric of society. And we shouldn't just button our lips and be silent about it. We should say, this is irrational, this is ungrounded, this is, you know, shame on you. You should know better than that. Or how about the people that the conspiracy theorists that say that the moon landing never happened? Well, you know, I'm sure that that claim is perfectly consistent with everything we know in science in a certain way, as a paranoid claim. But I think it does not deserve respect. It does not, and it certainly doesn't deserve, for instance, to be taught in the schools. And then raising the ante terribly, Holocaust deniers. That's another case of fantasies that aren't frivolous. There's another fantasy that isn't frivolous. And another one, which was all over the internet shortly before the election, is probably still there. And it seems to me that the fantasy that Obama is the Antichrist is one of the most pernicious and dangerous irrationalities on the planet, and it is everybody's job to say so. Or consider this case. This is Pervez Kambash, who was sentenced to execution for blasphemy in Afghanistan. Not in the Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, but in post-war Afghanistan. His sentence has been commuted to 20 years in prison. Not good enough. So I don't think that we should simply say, okay, it's within our rights, it's within your rights to maintain these views. They are not inconsistent with what we know from modern science. I think we have a right to hold people to a higher standard. In any case, I want to consider whether planting this particular version, the theistic Christian version, is in any better position than these other fantasies that I've mentioned. And just to give an example, I'm going to create my own planting-inspired version of guided natural selection. Superman, son of Jor-El, flew from the planet Krypton about 530 million years ago and ignited the Cambrian explosion, made famous in Steve Gould's book, Wonderful Life. Well, now, why did he do this? Well, he wanted to create a sort of plaything, a world to play with, a sort of giant Ken and Barbie world for himself. And so he arrived 530 million years ago and he tweaked the DNA of the fauna that had lived at that time in just the right way so that vertebrates and eventually mammals and eventually us would arrive on the scene. Now, here I simply put Superman in for planting in this quote. Superman could have caused the right mutations to arise at the right time. He could have preserved populations from perils of various sorts and so on. In this way, by orchestrating the course of evolution, he could have ensured that there come to be creatures of the kind he intends. Yeah? That's consistent with evolutionary theory. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. That's consistent. And I'm even going to propose some evidence. Here's the evidence that would actually convince me that this was true. We go up to the Burgess Shale in Canada, where the Burgess Shale fauna were found that really inspired Gould's book. We get some dynamite, and we do a little blasting, and we find at the bottom of this pit, looking at shale that has not been seen by anybody for 530 million years, we discover not the angel Moroni's golden plates, but Jor-El's golden plates. And what is on them turns out to be deciphered correctly as how to get the various gene duplications to occur so that the Berger shale fauna would multiply and we'd get the Cambrian explosion. Or another thing could happen. Allah could appear and say, I've been intervening in evolution for billions of years on this little planet. Would planting and say, I told you so? I wonder. That brings me to the end of my first point. I accept that he's right, that current evolutionary theory is consistent with these hypotheses, but I don't see that his has anything more going for it than my Superman one. I'd like to hear what it is that's so. Now, he's also right, and I'm being very short about this, that it is no part of current evolutionary theory to say that mutations are random, in the sense implying that they are implying that they are uncaused, that they are caused, they are said to be caused by cosmic rays, for example, still less do they occur just by chance. Now, this is indeed often misunderstood. Now, some years ago, in Elbowroom, I pointed out that even so great an evolutionary biologist as Jacques Monod could get this wrong. And in his book, Chance and Necessity, he says that evolution would not occur in, as he says, Laplace's world from which chance is excluded by definition. He seemed to think that indeterministic physics was a requirement for evolution to occur. It's just not. It's just not the case. And so Alvin is right about that. Evolution can occur just fine in deterministic worlds, as thousands of deterministic computer models of evolution demonstrate on a daily basis. They're all deterministic. They rely on pseudo-random number generators as the source of their so-called random mutations. So indeterminism is indeed a red herring, both for evolution and for free will, as I've argued for a long time. So now we get to number three. Evolutionary biology by itself doesn't imply the denial of divine design. This is also true, but in its own special way, which I will illustrate with a parallel story. Fred, the nasty art critic, has published a scathing review of an exhibit of Tom's art, and is found dead in his apartment the next day, his head bashed in by one of Tom's sculptures, which lies soaked in blood beside the corpse, with a published review draped over Fred's body. Murder most foul, it appears. But at Tom's trial, the defense is impressive. The sculpture in question has belonged to Fred for years. Can be seen perched precariously on a high shelf above his reading chair in a photograph taken a week earlier. Moreover, that morning, shortly after 9 o'clock, at which time Fred habitually read the morning paper, a moderate earthquake, see the evidence here in the seismograph, had shaken all the houses in the neighborhood. Many similar items were jiggled off shelves and tables in the neighborhood that day. There's no evidence that Tom was anywhere nearby, no sign of breaking or entering, no fingerprints, no DNA, etc. In all likelihood, it says the defense, Fred's death was, by natural causes, not a murder, not a death with an intending and intelligent author. Well, now, Tom's acquittal seems quite sure. But the prosecutor isn't finished. He calls an expert witness, Professor Plantinga. Do you believe that Tom murdered Fred? Yes, I do. But hasn't the defense shown that it was an accident, a death by natural causes, not a murder? No, the defense has shown, I grant, that it could have been an accident, but not that it was an accident.
There is no inconsistency between the case that the defense has made and the proposition, which I find entirely reasonable, that Tom was the deliberate author of Fred's death. Do you deny that there was an earthquake sufficient to topple the sculpture? No, but Tom could have arranged for the earthquake to happen just so. Nothing we know in geology by itself rules out the possibility that people can cause earthquakes by wishing for them hard enough. Or, as I've said, Satan and his minions may be involved in one way or another. I grant you that naturalism, combined with what we know of geology, has the implication that Fred's death almost certainly was not a murder. But naturalism has not been established or even defended in this court. Right. Naturalism, however, is tacitly assumed in all reputable courts of law and throughout scientific investigation. Now, naturalism raises a bit of a problem, I think, for Alvin. As Plantinga makes clear, naturalism is the creed he wants to discredit. This puts him in an awkward position. If he wants to champion the much maligned Michael Behe, he needs to make his peace with naturalism. Now, Alvin calls Behe's work serious and quantitative. I just beg to disagree. It is neither serious nor quantitative. It is a transparent concoction of bad science and bad rhetoric, and has been extremely patiently and well rebutted by well-regarded scientists. Now, Behe's so-called scientific work has been carefully judged by the scientific community and thoroughly rejected. The last thing Michael Behe needs is a defender who insists that naturalism is not to be assumed for the sake of argument. Without naturalism, Behe is just another theological speculator, not the scientist he claims to be. In this regard, a little recent history is relevant. In 1997, Alvin Plantinga and Peter Van Inwagen invited me to come to Notre Dame to debate Michael Behe on the subject of his first book, Darwin's Black Box. According to them, the Lehigh University biochemist, in his forthcoming book, Darwin's Black Box, was a deeply serious, high-quality challenge to evolutionary theory. My intellectual integrity as a Darwinian was on the line. Would I debate him? I took their endorsement seriously, and not being a biochemist, I asked for their permission to team up with somebody who knew the technicalities better than I did. I passed on their endorsement of Behe's book to my friend, the eminent Harvard evolutionary biologist David Haig, and he agreed to join me. When copies of the book arrived, we were appalled. This was not at all a serious scientific book, but a hugely disingenuous propaganda full of telling omissions and misrepresentations. We went to Notre Dame in April and dealt firmly, fairly, and objectively with Behe's claims, pointing out that his arguments were not just inconclusive, they gave every sign of willfully ignoring contrary evidence and argument. It was precious little rebuttal at the meeting at Notre Dame, and I figured that Hay and I had done our duty. I noticed that Plantinga no longer expresses any endorsement of Behe's first book, but now gives his layman's approval to his second book. I'm not biting. I pay my dues. I'm not going to debate about Behe's second book. Plantinga says, if Behe is right or anywhere near right, the probability of the existence of the cell as we find it is much greater on theism than on naturalism. Now, since Plantinga is a layman, as he notes, he is really in no position to assess the antecedent of this claim. He finds the case that Behe makes is, quote, reasonably powerful, though far from conclusive. Well, now, where might an inquiring layman turn, then, for further evidence? He might turn to the scientific reviews, for instance, by Sean Carroll in Science, or, say, P.Z. Myers on his blog for Intellect. Or he might consider the following probabilistic argument. This is my attempt at a probabilistic argument inspired by Alvin's example. So here's planting as probabilistic argument. If B is right or anywhere near right, the probability of the existence of the cell as we find it is much greater on theism than on naturalism. Here's mine. Let B be he is right or anywhere nearly right. And let N be knowledgeable scientists rush to their labs to steal, that should be S-B-A-L, Behe's thunder and win the Nobel Prizes that will surely be awarded to anyone who demonstrates irreducible complexity. I submit that the probability of N on B is actually very high. Remember cold fusion? If Behe is right or anywhere near right, why aren't there hordes of evolutionary biologists and biochemists out there trying to beat him to the punch by actually demonstrating a case of irreducible complexity? The silence from that camp is deafening, and for good reason. So N is false. Therefore, the probability that Behe is right or anywhere near right is negligible. But Behe is right about something, and this is sort of an interesting point. The Discovery Institute has formed something called the Biologic Institute in Seattle. And this, they claim, is going to be a world-class microbiology laboratory where I suppose largely Christian, but in any case, intelligent, design-minded scientists will try to prove irreducible complexity. And what Behe is right about is that there are large gaps in our knowledge of how complex features evolve, the sort of complex features that Alvin was just talking about in the cell. Now, there's a reason for that, and that is that there are a lot of these problems that's really a difficult and a thankless task. One of the reasons that we haven't got to them yet is that microbiology is a young field, and there are many thousands of nooks and crannies that we just haven't got around to yet. But moreover, there are a lot of really major problems that haven't even been tackled. And the reason why they haven't been studied is really quite interesting. The young researchers who have the training to do it prefer to tackle other topics. And why is that? Not because they fear there's no evolutionary explanation of them, but just almost the opposite. They fear that they would work hard for a decade or so and solve the problem and show exactly how these features evolved and hence are not, in spite of first appearances, irreducibly complex. And their scientific colleagues would say, in effect, so what else is new? Thank you, we always knew it evolved. It's not just that most researchers, being prudent and cautious with their careers, prefer to work on the low-hanging fruit. The topics that appear likely to produce significant results in a relatively short time, but that even those who are comfortable with the strategy of risking all for a Nobel Prize, no matter how arduous and uncertain the prospect, are pretty sure that no Nobel Prizes are to be found down the intelligent design pathways. That's how sure they are that the theory of evolution by natural selection is fundamentally confirmed. Of course, they might be wrong. But who would ever advise them to risk wasting their professional careers on such a hunch? That's why I welcome the founding of Biologic. Because it's designed to house and fund those talented researchers, if such can be found, who think they can disprove the theory of evolution. Let's hope they do first-rate science, and fill in a lot of the mildly embarrassing gaps in our knowledge of how various features evolve. If history is any guide, their quest for skyhooks will net with them with some interesting new cranes, and we'll all learn something. And in the meantime, we won't lose any sleep over their spending their time on wild goose chases, since they'll be on a crusade. And what could be more fulfilling than that, even if you come back empty-handed? Finally, the last point, is naturalism incompatible with evolution? In the argument which Alvin has just shown you, the first premise is that the probability that your cognitive faculties are reliable given naturalism and evolutionary theory, the probability is low. I think this is just plain false. I've argued that for years, so I'll be very brief in going over my reasons for that. If we use reverse engineering evaluations, we can measure the acuity, accuracy, reliability of sense organs in all animals we can compare the activity, for instance, of sight in the evil and in us and other creatures and so forth. And we can identify shortcomings, gaps, and distortions in the cognitive apparatus of many species, including ourselves. And then we can correct them in ourselves, and indeed we have. I'm wearing glasses. We all know all of the many prosthetic devices and innovations that we've done to correct the identified shortcomings in our God-given machinery, in our evolved machinery. We can identify, moreover, experimenter bias, logical fallacies, faulty probabilistic intuitions in science. Science is a systematic effort to remove the shortcomings, the cognitive shortcomings, and thus enhance the reliability. Our brains, as I have argued for years, are syntactic engines, not semantic engines. There is no such thing as a perpetual motion machine, a semantic engine, something that could respond directly and appositely to meaning. But what it can do is, what evolution can do is design what I call syntactic engines that track truth systematically. Consider hand calculators. It would be perfectly possible to make a hand calculator that got the answers all wrong. There wouldn't be much of a market for them. So similarly, there isn't much of a market for low reliability cognitive devices in the biosphere. So, passé Descartes, we don't need a benign God to support our trust in our cognitive faculties. Descartes didn't have the benefit of Darwin's ideas. By the way, I've written recently on that in J. Phil, my Descartes Argument from Design, which we just recently published. Now, thanks to the evolution of language, we and only we of all God's creatures have words as tools, which are good for representing our reasons. I'm going to use one example to stand for a panoply of ways in which we have improved our cognitive outreach. How do you draw a straight line? That's very simple. You take a piece of paper and a pencil and a straight edge. You put the straight edge on the paper and you draw the pencil on the straight edge, right? Use a straight edge. Where'd you get the straight edge? How do you make a straight edge? Well, the straight edge manufacturer has a... Well, he gets a piece of metal and he puts it down and he puts a straight edge on it and then he cuts along the straight edge. And where did he get that straight edge? From another super straight edge manufacturer. So forth. Well, not ad infinitum, obviously. Well, it turns out that there's an interesting history to the evolution, the cultural evolution of straight edges. And here is a circa 1960 box straight edge, about as good as you could make it at the time, and it can be very precisely described. And in particular, I love this graph. This shows the imperfection in the state-of-the-art block, gauge block. That's as good a straight edge as you could make back in those days. And that wiggly line you see is the deviations from perfection, the falling short of perfection of that straight edge. The fact that we can represent the goal and represent the reasons for the goal and represent the falling short of the goal using devices like graphs and words shows that we can improve our acuity, our cognitive reliability, apparently indefinitely. So, in other words, the ideal of the perfectly straight line doesn't, what Plato might have called the form of the straight, was in fact it arrived at by approximation, both of the artifact and of the idea itself. We can have bootstrapping, we don't need God from on high to tell us that our cognitive faculties are good. The form of the true has a similar history. Science is the system in which cultural items' means have been selected for veridicality. It's not perfect, but it's demonstrably better and better and better than it's ever been before. Darwinian naturalism is not a religion or even a quasi-religion. It isn't that because there is not a single facet of it which is simply taken on faith and which is not arguable and subject to skepticism. It's an excellent alternative to religion. I'm going to close with a little joke. Some of you may notice that I'm wearing my little Darwin pin, the fish with the legs, the evolving fish, says Darwin. So I was at an evolution meeting a few years ago, and the physicist Murray Gell-Mann was there, and he said, Dan, you know that the Tristan fish is the first acronym, that the Greek word ichthys is the word for fish, but it's an acronym for Jesus Christos Deo Eos Soter, Jesus Christ, God, Son, and Savior. That's why the Christians use the fish. Okay, I said, that's nice. He says, what I want to know is, what does D-A-R-W-I-N stand for? Okay, an interesting challenge. Well, I'm not much with the Greek, but I said, give me a half an hour and I'll see what I can come up with. So I decided to do Latin. We don't have a W in Latin, of course, but we do have a U. So here's D-A-R-W-I-N in Latin. Delere, auctorum rerum, ut universum infinitum noscas. Destroy the author of things in order to understand the infinite universe. Thanks for your attention.
First, I think I strongly suspect there is something in what I said that Dan Bennett disagrees with, but I've been having a little difficulty in seeing just what it is. And I enjoyed the stories about the silly stories about Superman and the really nasty art critic and the like of that. I'm not so clear exactly as to how all this bears on what I had in mind and what I wanted to say. At first, I thought when I first read Dan's paper, I thought what he had in mind was something like this. We were asked to discuss the question whether science and religion are compatible. And I argued that they are, at least with respect to the particular point at issue about evolution. And then he agreed, but he goes on to say something like this, that there are lots of really silly propositions compatible with science, and theism is one of them. On further thought, though, it struck me maybe that's not really the structure of his argument. It wasn't that he was claiming that theism, although he does say at one point, he says, I myself cannot see any rational grounds for preferring his, that is, my theism over my, that is, his Supermanism. It occurred to me that probably he wasn't thinking about theism when he was comparing some hypothesis of mine to these silly stories about Superman and the like, but rather the thought that God guided and orchestrated, or rather my claim that it's possible that God could have guided and orchestrated the course of evolution. I wanted to argue that theism and Darwinism are compatible. I wanted to do so by providing some third proposition R, such that it's pretty clear that theism and Darwinism and R are all compatible, from which it would follow that theism and Darwinism are. And the R in question was the suggestion, was this proposition, God guided and orchestrated the course of evolution to produce the kinds of creatures he wanted. Well, of course, then first of all, I'm not committed to the truth of this proposition. It's just another case of showing that a pair of propositions P and Q are compatible by finding some third proposition R, which is compatible with P and Q, and the conjunction of all three is possible, from which it follows that P and Q are. So I'm not committed to that proposition, but the fact is, I'm not committed to it, but maybe Dan's thinking something like this. That must be the only way, that's the only R in town, that must be the only way in which it could be that Darwinism and theism are compatible. And if that proposition is very implausible or has very low probability, then one can hold that Darwinism and theism are compatible only at the cost of believing something that's really improbable, really implausible. And perhaps he wanted to argue that this proposition, my R, is really implausible or improbable by comparing it to his Supermanism. Now, I am inclined to think Supermanism is a relatively foolish proposition. I mean, that there should be something like a human-like being that can do that. I mean, we could go on and talk instead about, say, Dennettism, which would be the thought that Dan Dennett was actually there 500 million years ago and interfered in the course of evolution. intervened and brought it about that there should now be creatures of the sort there are, human creatures and so on, I would consider that a really silly proposition too. But I can't see why either supermanism or identism is anything like the proposition that God has so intervened. The main reasons would be that we know perfectly well that human-like creatures and human beings don't live that long. Very few of them achieve an age of 500 million years. And furthermore, they're not capable of that kind of activity. So it seems to me there's really no, as far as I can see, there is no similarity between these two. By pointing out that supermanism is a silly proposition, a silly belief thesis, it in no way follows that the suggestion that God has intervened in the course of evolution to produce the kinds of creatures he wants, in no way follows that that's silly at all. Just a couple more little points here. Dan says something like this. He says that, I can't seem to find this particular thing I'm looking for here. Hold on a second. Oh yeah. Dan claims that naturalism is tacitly assumed in all respectable or reputable courts of law and throughout scientific investigation. Now if he's using the word naturalism the way I defined it in my paper, then this seems to me to be clearly false, to be obviously false. In physics, for example, it's not assumed that there is no such person as God. There are lots of theistic physicists. These physicists don't take it that in doing physics they have to assume there's no such person as God. Rather, what they think they are doing is exploring, explaining, discovering how this world, which in fact God has created, how it works. It may be that they will not produce hypotheses that directly entail the existence of God, but that's a totally different question. As for Michael Behe, I'll say only this. There's a lot to say on this head, but of course we don't have the time. Let me say only that my recollection of his visit to Notre Dame is very different from Dennis. Very different from Dennis. It does not seem to me, as I remember it, it's not at all the case that, he wasn't shown to be a charlatan, he wasn't shown to be mistaken, as I remember it. I thought he held his own very well with respect to Dennett and his friend. Dennett is right in suggesting that the creed I want to discredit is naturalism. That is, the creed I want to discredit in the evolutionary argument against naturalism, anyway, is naturalism. It's an argument against naturalism. But I must say I was disappointed in his response to my evolutionary argument against naturalism. He basically simply announces that evolution has in fact produced us, and that in fact our beliefs do track the truth. But that's not an issue at all. I do not mean for a minute to argue that evolution has not produced us, nor for a minute that our beliefs do not track the truth. That isn't the question. The question is rather whether what the probability that our faculties should be reliable is, given evolution and naturalism. I gave an argument for supposing that probability is low. It seems to me Dan didn't mention the argument. Finally,
he mentioned premise one.
Yeah, he mentioned premise
one. He did mention it. Premise one.
He did mention it, but I gave an argument for premise one, which Dan didn't, as far as I can see, even mention. So he did mention premise one. And I'm grateful for that. Dennett does propose an analogy, one which I actually like, the handheld calculator. He asked us to think about handheld calculators, which track the truth even though they are, in his sense, syntactic, in his term, syntactic engines, not semantic engines. But this seems to be an unfortunate analogy from Dennett's point of view. Calculators, of course, are designed and created by intelligent beings, namely us. They do indeed track the truth, and they do so because they've been designed to do that by us. That's just the way a theist would think of human beings. Theists would think of human beings as, for the most part at least, tracking the truth because they were created and designed to track the truth by God. If we want to put the evolutionary argument I was giving into the context of Dennett's analogy, we would suppose that calculators reproduce themselves, let's say, with occasional copy errors, leading to different electronic designs. And some of these designs would be somehow adaptive with respect to their reproducing themselves. Furthermore, let's suppose these calculators produce shapes on a screen, as in fact they do. And finally, let's suppose that these machines were not planned or designed by any intelligent beings at all. What would be the probability then, on those suppositions, that these shapes on the screen are English sentences that express truths? I guess it's pretty low.
All right, so let's open it up now for questions, and please direct your questions to one of the speakers.
Right. If I've understood what President Dennett is trying to say, the...
try to speak as loudly as possible.
The argument that he gave in response to your naturalistic argument is that if our cognitive faculties were unreliable, then there seems to be no possible way that we could actually make the sorts of improvements that he's referring to over the various levels of acuity. Unless, of course, our cognitive faculties were systematically unreliable, like we were living in some sort of Cartesian demon world or something like that. So, if the sort of naturalistic story is true, the reason why our cognitive faculties are unreliable is precisely because having reliable cognitive faculties is evolutionarily adaptive and advantageous to survival. Where's the breakdown there?
Well, I don't know if everybody could hear that question.
You can repeat it, that would be great.
Yeah, although I'm afraid I can't because I don't quite understand it.
The question is, as I understood Professor Dennett's response to your naturalistic argument, the reason why it seems unlikely, to say the least, that our cognitive faculties would be unreliable if the naturalistic story is true is because it seems highly likely that having reliable cognitive faculties would be an advantage in any sort of environment. If you had grossly unreliable cognitive faculties, then you probably aren't going to survive the pass on your genes. So the only way that you could survive in such a way is if you were sort of systematically unreliable. So for every mistake I have in a cognitive faculty, there's something else in the environment that adapts to it. So that would seem to suggest that the only way we could be so systematically deceived is if there was some sort of being, like a god, that was deliberately deceiving us and deliberately manipulating us. So,
I think, first of all, it's right to say that that the accuracy of cognitive faculties is adaptive. That is to say, consider a frog. A frog has got cognitive faculties of a certain sort. A fly goes by, the frog tongue flicks out and the like. So there have to be some kind of indicators in that frog, that could be part of its cognitive situation, which is such that it brings it about that when the fly flits by, the frog's tongue flicks out and captures the frog. Captures the fly. Right. This doesn't have anything to do so far with belief. Maybe the frog also has beliefs. Maybe the same physiology that produces this adaptive behavior also produces beliefs. But does it matter whether the beliefs produced are true? Seems to me it doesn't. Suppose the frog is, who knows what this frog is thinking as it does that? Maybe it's not thinking anything. What counts is the adaptivity of the neurophysiology and the behavior. That'll be connected in some way. Maybe the same neurophysiology causes beliefs of a certain kind. But it doesn't matter whether those beliefs are true. What counts for adaptivity is that neurophysiology, behavior, the way the beliefs, how they go, that really doesn't matter.
Okay, right there. You? Yeah? Speak up, please.
With regard to your comment about how you can't see an interesting difference between planning a theism and the Superman hypothesis, I'm wondering if you think this is one. We don't know very many intelligent people who accept the Superman hypothesis, but there are scores of distinguished and intelligent philosophers in this room and other intelligent people outside the room who favor the theistic version.
I don't think that makes a whole lot of difference. There was a time when there were a whole lot of intelligent people that believed in Jupiter and Thor and Baal and so forth. I think we have a pretty good explanation of why there should be intelligent people that maintain these faiths. And so I don't think it's much... It's not, to me, a compelling reason to think that the Christian theism is first of all, any better than Islamic theism or any better than any other variety of theism in the world or indeed in Supermanism. Supermanism hasn't had a chance to be propounded. Who knows? Maybe if we got out there and started spending billions of dollars on Superman churches, we pretty soon have a majority. You know, hard to tell.
Yeah, a comment and a question. It's directed to Al, actually. You expressed a different view about what happened at Notre Dame when Dennis was there and so on. You and I were in Baylor together, and BB was in the audience, and I was giving one of the opening addresses. I think you were chairing the session. And at that talk, I essentially put forward a number of criticisms of BB's irreducible complexity argument. Some were purely philosophical points. A number appeared to the discussion by Kenneth Miller in Finding Darwin's God. And at the end of my talk, you mentioned that I've been talking about everything as well, had been criticizing Professor Beattie fairly strongly, and you gave him the opportunity to respond to that point to my criticism. And he declined that kind of invitation, saying that he would do so in his talk the next day. I then went to the talk the next day, and there was no response to criticisms at all, right? So I think that's grounds for being suspicious of the intellectual quality of Beattie's approach. The question is this. In setting out the argument of the incompatibility of naturalism and evolution in the last page and a half of your handout tonight, there's no reference at all to what I take to be the crucial issue that needs to be addressed. And that is that the content of mental states, the most plausible account of the content of mental states, is one that brings causation into it. And in our late volume, I argued that once you bring that in, then the probability is not 0.5, the fundamental belief system, it's much, much higher, okay, right? And so I think that's the crucial objection. I think many philosophers in the language agree with me that the theory of content is crucial. And so the question is, why don't you address that objection?
Well, if the question is why didn't I address the objection in this paper that I just gave, the paper is already pretty long for our circumstances here. But I'm perfectly happy to do so. Let's say, I mean, you're suggesting there's got to be some kind of causal connection between the circumstances in question and the content that gets that emerges. Maybe so. If we thought in terms of non-reductive materialism of the nomological variety, that would be what you're talking about. I mean, that would just be a case where you get causality, you get by virtue of, you get a causality, a causal relationship between the neurophysiology and its adaptiveness on the one hand and the content on the other. I can't see the slightest reason, though, given that there is such a causal connection, to think that the content has to be true. It could just as well be false. It gets caused, all right, by the neurophysiology, and the neurophysiology is adaptive, but it certainly doesn't follow, as far as I can see, that the content has to be true. Could just as well be false.
I would just say, this is not the argument in Knowledge of God. Those are instead in my arguments in what the book.
Could I just like to say something? Alvin said I did address his premise one, the argument for it, but I would make an argument along the lines that you were making. And in fact, I've done that for my whole career. The alternative that he's suggesting is a little bit like saying, by the way, I have no idea what Pat Churchland meant when she said the truth takes the hindmost, except that she was perhaps thinking that in every specific instance, whether or not a belief or a mental state of any sort is true, is not going to determine what it does. It'll do what it does as a matter of, as it were, mechanical causation. But the claim that systems can't be designed that track truth and that are causally designed to track truth, everything in cognitive science and in evolutionary biology suggests strongly that that's exactly what has happened, that evolution has created these things where there is a deep causal relation between truth and those states, and that the states, there are most importantly, and this is a point that Fred Dretske has gotten close to, but never quite, I think, nailed it right. If a mental state, for one reason or another, ceases to track truth, there are mechanisms to disassemble it, to take it apart. In other words, that it persists in tracking truth is a sort of precondition for its continuing in the system. Now, if you think that's sort of magical, it is not. It is quite possible to design such systems. It's quite possible for evolution to design such systems. And the line that Alvin has taken is a little bit like saying, I don't see any reason to see why evolution explains that wings work so well for flying. Well, wings are forced for surviving. Doesn't say anything about flying. But of course, the only way that wings help you as an adaptation is by flying really well. That's what wings are for. And what cognitive systems are for is getting it right. That's why they evolved. So the 50%, the coin flip suggestion that the Alvin makes, I think, is completely ungrounded.
Okay. Yeah.
So I have one question for Professor Bennett, one question for Professor Blandinger.
Pick one.
Okay. Professor Blandinger. So you gave an argument for probability of R given energy being lower in square root of low in this case. And what I'm wondering is this. It seems at first glance that the argument might prove a bit too much. Can everyone hear me? Okay, I'll speak up. It seems that the argument for the probability thesis, the probability of R given N and E is low, might prove too much for the following reason. Let's take another belief that naturalists hold, say the belief that humans and their cognitive faculties were formed near the surface of a planet. Now, relative to that belief, which isn't perhaps included in naturalism and evolutionary theory, but relative to that belief, if you look at any belief of your hypothetical population, then the probability of that belief being true will also be, say, 0.5. So if you take that belief, which, you know, say, both theists and naturalists accept, then you can still get some version of the probability thesis relative to that. And so I'm wondering what the difference is between these two cases, because in the case that I'm describing, the argument seems to go through and you might get a defeater merely on the basis of believing that we were formed near a planet.
Let's see if I understand. You're suggesting that there are some other propositions with respect to which the proposition in question is unlikely, and therefore we get a defeater, or therefore we might. But I don't think you get a defeater just any old time. You believe something P, and also believe something else Q, with respect to which it's improbable. That happens only under certain circumstances. I mean, there are all kinds of things, I believe, that are improbable with respect to each other, but don't constitute defeaters.
Right.
So, for example, I've just dealt out a bridge hand.
Mm-hmm.
The probability that you get just that bridge hand in a deal is something like 1 out of 10 to the 28th, I believe.
Right.
Very, very low.
Right.
But I don't get a defeater for either one of those beliefs under those conditions.
Right.
It's got to be something special. It's got to be, in this case, some proposition which is importantly about the origin and provenance of the cognitive faculties and the like. If with respect to that, this probability is low, then I think one does get a defeater. With respect to what Dan was saying a moment ago about flying, eagles and the like, absolutely. I think that is how it turns out that flying is adaptive. Because it enables the ego to do what it has to do and the like of that. And I think that's also true with respect to cognitive faculties. So when you consider the neurology as part of the cognitive faculties, there have to be indicators, which indicators are accurate in one's body. So for example, there are lots of indicators of, say, the saline content of your blood and so on and so on. There have to be the right kind of indicators. But there doesn't have to be the right kind of belief to go with these indicators. That's a totally different subject. The underlying neurophysiology has to be such that it produces adaptive behavior. Perhaps that underlying neurophysiology also produces, either by way of logical supervenience or causal supervenience, belief with a certain content, but it in no way follows that that content has to be true. Maybe it's true, maybe it's false.
Of course,
I'm not arguing that. I'm not arguing for skepticism. I'm not saying that's in fact the way it is, that our beliefs do not track the truth, not for a minute. All I'm saying is that's what the probability would be given just naturalism and evolution.
All right, let's take one last question. Dan?
Question for Dan. I just wanted to hear more. You seem to believe that the probability that we all have good reason to think the probability of evolutionary naturalism is quite high. Mm-hmm. It's the naturalism part that I wanted to hear about. I mean, I could speculate that you think, given the explanatory success of science, this is part of what you would appeal to. But I'd like to just a sketch. How does the story go? Does it go through some kind of empiricist conception of knowledge or what? I'm not hearing how you think a metaphysical thesis like naturalism is made likely. Just like to hear you talk about it.
Well, since I've only got a few minutes at most to talk about it, I'll just make one point of many that I'd make. I think that the natural sciences can provide us with a very compelling explanation of why and how people came to believe in God, which does not at all suppose that it would be a true belief. But if we can diagnose the etiology of belief in God, and even make predictions about how and why this would be the case and how it would work, then we have undercut the presumption that because so many people believe it, it must be true. If we've got a good theory that explains how sort of massive systematic falsehood could arise in a human population and be maintained over generations, then that in itself is a pretty good reason for supposing that we've got a good handle on this, better than their handle on science.
All right, well, let's thank both of our speakers.